Okay, let's get started. Before I forget, because it's very possible that I will forget, next week we do not have class. Missing a week, and we will come back the following week. All right. So just I'll try to remember to say that again at the end, but just be aware. Okay. So we are going into a topic today that, in many ways is a complicated topic and a controversial topic. And I am guessing that a lot of people here have opinions and thoughts about it. And certainly in the last few months might have different, your thoughts may have changed. And so there may be a lot of comments in the chat that we'll try to get to at the end. We're going to try to look somewhat at the politics because you can't ignore the politics in this situation, but really at the history. And I have to say on a personal note that this whole story of Gush Katif and Yamit, I did not live through in Israel. But Gush Katif, the disengagement from Gush Katif, I definitely did live through. And I'm processing my feelings towards it, 20 years later, 18 years later. So that's going to be something that's going to come up as we're going. So today we are going to look at not at the area that we've been looking at till now, right? Basically the areas on the border with Gaza. But today we're going to be looking at attempts at a greater Israel, okay? Settlement attempts both in the Northern Sinai and what's called the Yamit region, as well as in the Gaza Strip itself, in Gush Katif. We're going to take a look at those attempts. We're also going to see that this is the first time that Israel really dealt with voluntarily withdrawing from a territory. Okay, we had situations like that in 1948 in the middle of the War of Independence, but this was during peacetime, a very different kind of a situation. How did we deal with it? How did it set the template for the future? Could there have been, we talk about the Gaza envelope, Otef Gaza. Could there have been an envelope for the envelope, right? Could we have had another layer of Jewish settlement? And that's one of the things we're going to take a look at. And basically, what were these communities and what were the hopes for them? So the pictures I brought you here is greenhouses in one of the yeshuvim in Morag. Agriculture is very much a part of the story, certainly in Gush Katif, in Yamit as well, but definitely in Gush Katif. And that's going to be part of our story. So we will start, as always, with a timeline. Okay, and for this timeline, we're already in the sovereign state of Israel. Most of what we're going to be talking about is after the Six-Day War, but important for us to have that background of the Sinai campaign in 1956. Okay, this is probably Israel's least known war. Okay, it's one of those things that we, I don't know, somehow it gets lost in the shuffle of all the different stories that we have. But it actually is a very important story because it shows what Israel's military potential was, okay, when Israel was all of 8 years old. And it also shows our desire to be present in Sinai. So we're going to see that we got the Sinai, we gave back the Sinai, and then we get it again. Okay, so that's really why my timeline here starts in 1956 as opposed to 1967. Operation Kadesh in 56, the Sinai campaign, we'll go into it a little bit more. A year later, less than a year later, 6 months later, Israel withdraws from the territory that it conquered. Of course, the next 10 years later, June 67, we have the Six-Day War. And after 67, there's a plan to create more of a buffer zone, right? To have more communities between us and Egypt. Now that the Gaza Strip and the Sinai post 67 are not in Egypt anymore, let's have more Jewish communities, more Israeli communities, both in the pre 67 area of the Western Negev, which had already begun to be settled, Eshkol, Besor, but also in post 67, Gush Katif and Northern Sinai. Okay? And we're going to be kind of interspersing Yamit's story. We're going to tell them one at a time, but understand that they are interspersed in terms of dates. Okay? The communities in Gush Katif begin in the 70s. The cornerstone for Yamit and some of the communities are even before this is in 1975. So they're kind of happening at the same time. We'll deal with them separately. Very, very major watershed event. November 1977, Anwar Sadat, the president of Egypt, visits Israel. This, of course, leads to the Camp David Accords and the peace treaty with Egypt, which then leads to Israel leaving Hevel Yamit and giving it to Egypt and destroying the communities that were built there. Relocating, right? We're going to see to where. Some of them relocate to Gush Katif and then have to relocate a second time in 2005 when we have the story of the disengagement from Gush Katif. Okay, so that's just to give us the larger picture like we always like to have. So let's start with the story of Sinai. Okay, there is a crisis with the Suez. And again, we're going to thank Professor Martin Gilbert again. I apologize. As always, we are devoting our learning to the health and the recovery of all of our wounded soldiers and hostages, to the safe and immediate return of all the hostages, and to our victory in this terrible war. Okay, let's go back to the Sinai. So here we have Dr. Gilbert again giving us another wonderful map. This is actually the Israeli withdrawal from the Sinai in March 57. I figured we didn't need both the conquest and the withdrawal for you to understand what we're talking about. But let's do a little bit of a background. Okay, we have a military uprising, a coup in Egypt where King Farouk is deposed in the early 50s and Gamal Abdel Nasser comes into power. His second in command eventually becomes president himself is Anwar Sadat. Lots of tension in the early to mid 50s between Israel and Egypt. Terror attacks from Gaza, as we saw, we talked about this last time, terror attacks from Gaza into Israel, Israeli reprisals into Gaza. So you have a lot of tensions about that. Plus, you have interesting tensions between Egypt and the British and the French. Right? And this is kind of the last gasp of British and French power in the Middle East before the power is really taken over by the two new superpowers, which is, of course, the U.S. and the Soviet Union. The British, there's a lot of tension over the control of the Suez Canal, right? Just to take a look, this is called the Suez Crisis, right? The Suez Canal, of course, being this extremely important thoroughfare that helps ships to avoid having to go all the way around Africa. So there's tension with the British over who controls the Suez Canal. There's a proxy Cold War going on. The Soviets want to start arming Egypt instead of them getting supplies from the West. Meanwhile, Israel is making alliances with the French. All of this comes to a head in July of 56. Nasser nationalizes the Suez Canal, right, makes it part of Egypt, and closes it and the Straits of Tehran. Straits of Tehran are down here, right? If these names sound familiar, it's because it's going to happen all over again 10 years later in 67. And he closes this to Israeli shipping. And Israel makes kind of a secret agreement with the British and the French to go to war against the Egyptians. The Israelis really take the brunt of it. They invade the Sinai, but the British and the French also attack in Port Said. And ultimately, what happens? There's a full week of war. And that's all. It's only a week where we specialize in these lightning short battles. In that war, Israel takes all of the Sinai and Gaza. And then what happens? We have very few casualties. We have 172 casualties in this battle. We've taken this huge amount of territory. But then, of course, there's a lot of pressure from the United States to withdraw. And that's what you're seeing here in March of 1957. Now, the aftermath is a very interesting aftermath. On the one hand, we lose all this territory. On the other hand, here we are 8 years into our existence. Okay, we're still little Israel. We're still with a very struggling economy. We're still trying very hard to absorb all those immigrants. And this is our first kind of testing ground, proving ground after 48. And wow, here we are. We're playing with the big boys. We managed to vanquish Egypt in a week and take this massive territory. So it's very much a shot in the arm of confidence for the Israeli army, which we hadn't really felt then. And it's kind of a prelude to 67. For the British, for the French, it works in the other way. They're very humiliated by this story. And for the Jews, the Egyptian Jewish community, it's essentially the end of hundreds and hundreds of settlement. Basically, there are many sanctions against them by the Egyptian government, and most of them make their way out and leave, whether it's for Israel or for France or for the US. So there are a lot of different repercussions to this event in 1956. And we're going to see that it kind of gives us a little bit of the confidence and the desire to go into Sinai when this becomes possible in 1967. Right? The picture on the right here, of course, is Moshe Dayan, with the troops in Sharm el-Sheikh all the way down at the bottom, right, of the Sinai Peninsula. That's what's going on over here. Okay, jump forward to the story that we know a little bit better. And that, of course, is the story of the Six-Day War. Okay? We're not going to tell the story of the Six-Day War here. What's important for our purposes is we move from really little Israel, little surviving Israel, but little Israel of the map here on the left, to this suddenly Israel that controls this huge amount of territory. Okay, huge is a relative term, but still a very large amount of territory compared to what we had before. So, of course, we have the story of the Golan, we have the story of Judea and Samaria. So, we're not going to talk about those stories anymore right now, but we are now here going to talk about Gaza and the Sinai, right? The same territory that we had taken in 1956. Now we get it in 1967. And at this point, there's nobody who's pushing us out. And the question is, how do we utilize this huge chunk of land that we've got? Right. And the question is, can we create a buffer zone between us and Egypt, like I mentioned before? Hey, can we try to prevent terrorist attacks on the Jewish communities that plagued us throughout the 50s and the 60s, plus an idea of expansion? We want to expand. We have immigrants who are coming. We want to be able to expand. We want to be able to have more territory. And that's the lead up to our stories of Hevel Yamit, the Yamit block, and Gush Katif. Okay, so let's look first at Yamit. Sorry, why are we not moving here? No, why am I frozen? Oh, sorry. What's going on here? Okay, thank you. Okay. One more. Sorry, my PowerPoint seems to be going crazy. Okay, here we go. The concept is, first of all, there are a few smaller communities that are created first, mostly Heyachzut Nachal, right? We talked about the Nachal last time. These army-led communities that are already begun in the late 60s. But the concept is to create a region around one major city, and that major city is going to be called Yamit, and smaller communities all around it. The city Yamit is going to be a hub. The concept was to have 200,000 people in this city. Okay, we'll see what it's supposed to include. But I thought it would be nice. We'll see if it works. I don't know if the PowerPoint is going to let us. But I would like to be able to show you at least part of a very interesting video about this area. Okay, in 1969, Naomi Shemer, right? We all know Naomi Shemer, the songwriter of Jerusalem of Gold and so many other beautiful songs. Naomi Shemer was invited to come down to one of these Nachal settlements in the northern Sinai. Everything we're talking about now is the Northern Sinai. We're not going to, let's just go back a second, right? When we talk about settlements in the Sinai, we have a few down here, right, near Eilat. We have three, but the main settlement block that we're talking about when we talk about Yamit is this area of the Northern Sinai. Okay, so Naomi Shemer is invited to come down and to see these Nachal settlements and to tour them. And she's so impressed by what she saw that she comes back and she writes a song that's called "Beheyachzut HaNachal B'Sinai." It becomes a big hit, and eventually they make a video clip in one of these communities that's called Neot Sinai. Sinai, which eventually becomes a Yishuv. Let's see if it will work. We're going to try it. All right. And tell me if you're hearing it. I hope you are. Yes? Give me a thumbs up, Judy. Okay. Okay. So yes, what you're seeing here is the sing. This is the Nachal band. Let's make this big. This is Miri Aloni. Okay, she's in the actual place, and there are no actors except for her. These are all the soldiers who are actually there. I'll translate some of it afterwards.
We don't see the video.
We hear, but we don't see anything.
You don't see?
No, we can hear, but not see a video. There's video unavailable. Watch on YouTube.
All right. Sorry. And I will. Okay, we'll go back. All right, so let's go back because if you're not seeing it, then it doesn't help us so much.
I think you also have to push the little button on the right here below.
The button on the right here below.
Let's see, there's like a little arrow below where it says video unavailable. I think you have to push that button also.
All right. Well, hold on. Let's go back to our sharing. Let's end this and go back to our screen share.
Click where it says watch on tube and then go down and hit the other little thing, I think.
Let's try it. Hold on. Yeah, I tried that, but then that didn't work. All right, Lo Nora, what's the idea that's going on here? Okay, this is a community down in the Sinai, and Naomi Shemer goes down there. And the song is a beautiful song. I highly recommend listening to it. And she talks about how it's as if she went back in time, right? There are all these soldiers with long braids, and they're walking around, and they're reading poetry, and everything is so simple. And it's Eretz Yisrael Hayishana, the good old days of the land of Israel. And she's very charmed by it. And it's very interesting because part of the appeal of this idea of going down here and maybe less in the 60s, but more post-73, is this idea that you're going back to a simpler time in Israel. You're going back to the pioneering spirit, and you're not part of the money grubbing of the towns and the cities. And you're going back to this beautiful area where you are going to be a pioneer. And really they're going down here and they're building almost on virgin territory, not really virgin territory because there were Bedouin there who were kicked out. Okay? But they really are building a lot from the beginning, and you're seeing laying foundations of homes, laying foundations for the roads. And the concept was really going to be a very ideal concept that you're going to have this beautiful, beautiful area by the sea, right, where you could have a port, where you could have a center for Olim, for new immigrants. Right? You could have a yeshiva. You could have education. You could have hotels and tourism. That was the goal, right? 200,000 people. They wanted to be the third largest coastal city in Israel. But what actually happened? Only about 600 families move into the city of Yamit. Plus, you had all these other satellite communities around there. But really, we're only talking about a few thousand people. It's really very small. And as it's starting, it's getting off the ground, it's starting to develop, something very unprecedented happens. And that's Anwar Sadat comes to Israel. Now, to understand how enormous this is, okay, Israel, after the Six-Day War, right, 3 weeks after the war, Levi Eshkol is the prime minister. Israel offers the Arab countries territories in exchange for peace. Three no's, right? Very famous conference. The Arabs say no to any agreements, no to recognizing Israel's existence, right? Absolutely not. No Arab countries will recognize us. No Arab countries are interested in any kind of conversation with us. And that's why Anwar Sadat comes, right? He's the president of Egypt. He becomes the president after Nasser in 1970 until he's He's assassinated in 1981. He's the president during the Yom Kippur War. And he, in the aftermath of the Yom Kippur War, which on the one hand was terrible for Israel, but on the other hand, we ultimately did win. So there's a lot of humiliation for the Egyptians. There's also an economic crisis in Egypt. And Sadat kind of wants to turn towards the West. And he knows that turning towards the West is going to, he's going to have to make some kind of an overture to Israel. Meanwhile, what's going on in Israel? 1977 is the year of the Mapach, of the revolution. After 29 years of labor-led government, Menachem Begin is in power. So things are changing, and Sadat sees an opportunity, and he gets in touch through the U.S., and he says, I want to come to Israel. And people here are very skeptical. Ah, it's a trick. It's a fake. He doesn't really. And then he comes, right? And he comes to the airport, and he's, of course, greeted in this very royal way. And everyone is in shock. And he comes, and he speaks in the Knesset. He says, I want to make a peace agreement with you. And Menachem Begin goes with it, which is actually astounding, right? Begin, who had built his reputation as the firebrand, as the leader of the Irgun, no to reparations with Germany, right? Hard line all the way. And he also sees an opportunity. And they agree to have a conversation. Of course, from that conversation to actually coming to an agreement takes a very long time with a lot of American intervention. They go to America, Camp David Accords with Jimmy Carter, lots of very, very long conversations, which ultimately end up with the agreement that you see here on the right, right? With Israel withdrawing from almost all of the Sinai, not from Gaza, okay, but withdrawing. In return, getting a normalization of relations with Egypt, meaning Israelis can go to Egypt, meaning they recognize us, passage through the Suez Canal, right? All of these very important things, but in return, giving up this huge amount of land. And this is brought to the Knesset, right? Begin wants to have the popular vote. He wants the Knesset to vote on this. He doesn't want to do it unilaterally without the approval of the people. It comes to a vote in the Knesset. 84 vote in favor, 19 vote no, and we'll talk about the composition of the votes in a minute, and 17 abstain. Okay, overwhelming in favor, but what's interesting are the no's, right? Some of the no's, of course, are from the right, from hardline right. Now, remember, Begin is right, right? He's from the Likud, but there are people from the Likud who are against. We're going to talk in a minute about Geula Cohen. But you also have no's from labor, notably from Yigal Alon, who we're going to talk about in connection with Gush Katif. But Yigal Alon feels this is a security nightmare. It's a disaster. Among the abstentions, as opposed to the no's, is Yitzhak Shamir, right? So people went in very different directions, didn't always follow their politics. But what did happen after this is that you have the formation of the hard right party of Tria, which is more to the right than the Likud, which is a combination of Gush Emunim, the Land of Israel movement, Chirut, that is fighting against this whole idea of giving up any kind of territory. But ultimately, it's voted through, and the withdrawal begins from 1979 to 1982. 82 is when they leave Yamit. And it's the first real example of Israel withdrawing voluntarily from territory that they've built up. It's a very difficult thing. A lot of communities are uprooted. A lot of people are relocated. Some people choose to leave before they're actually taken away. Hey, they voluntarily choose to leave. They voluntarily choose to relocate. We'll see where they go in a minute. But there's also political resistance. There's also fighting back. Most of it is peaceful. Some of it is from residents. Some of it is from outside people. Hey, one of the real firebrands, we'll talk about two of them. One is Tzachi Hanegbi. Tzachi Hanegbi, who was a student at the time, eventually becomes a politician. He's still a politician today. He's the son of Geula Cohen. Right? He is very strongly against. He ends up being one of the activists that besieged, that basically like put themselves on top of a monument in the middle of Yamit and refused to leave for 3 weeks. finally in April, on April 23rd, the final Pinoy, the final evacuation from this building. You can see the picture here on the right. You have activists who put themselves up on top of the buildings. The soldiers have to climb up and get them. There's fighting back and forth. There's foam that's sprayed at them. Ultimately, they come down and they're taken away. But you can see these heartrending pictures that we're going to see in a few minutes repeated in Katif of the soldiers and the residents. What?
You are frozen. Oh, now you're back again.
I'm frozen. I see myself. I think that I'm okay. Right?
No.
Okay. One of the other people who's very, very involved here, and he's not a politician anymore. He retired from politics, and then he passed away tragically too young, is Hanan Porat. Hanan Porat was a very, very interesting, brilliant person. He was one of the children of Kfar Etzion, born in Kfar Etzion before 1948, obviously had to leave with 1948. He's one of the founders of Yeshivat Har Etzion in Alon Shvud of the Gush, but he's one of the founders of Gush Emunim and is very, very involved in settling Samaria and in fighting against the evacuation from Yamit. And he goes to address the Knesset when this is beginning to be happening, right? It's right before they're going to evacuate Yamit. And he starts speaking in the Knesset, and he says, I'm going to start with a prayer. And the prayer is, Elokai Nitzor Lishoni Meira, God, please stop me from saying bad things. He says, everything I'm going to say now is not coming from hatred. It's coming from pain. And I have pain. My heart is full of love for the people of Israel and for the land of Israel. And please don't do this. But it doesn't work. And Yamit is evacuated. And the question next is where to go. Now, many of the communities resettle in an area that's very close to the area that we've been talking about up until now. This is an area that's called Hevel Shalom. It's essentially pretty empty until the 80s. It's to the southwest of the areas of the Gaza envelope that we've been talking about. So, for example, Nirim is right over here, and Be'eri is up here, and Re'im. And these are new communities that are right up against the border, both the border with Gaza and the border with Egypt. And a lot of these communities were attacked on October 7th. But everything here that you see that's highlighted in yellow, these were communities in Yamit that relocated to here, Sufa, Cholit, Prigan, Yated, Avshalom, as well as others. Today, there's a community called Dekel, also right near Yated. Ted, I don't know why it's not on my map. Oh, is it? It's here. And that has a museum for Yamit. We also have the relocation of this monument. Now, this is a crazy story. In the picture on the left, you can see the original. This is called the steel monument, Andartat Ugdat HaPlada, the division of steel monument. This was a monument that was put up in the center of Yamit, of the city of Yamit, in 1977 as a memorial to the tank corps who fell in battles in the Northern Sinai in 1967, 176 soldiers who fell. And this was put up. It is a very evocative monument with all of these pillars and a center pillar that you could actually go up to the top. This is where Tzachi Hanegbi and other activists stayed for 3 weeks in resistance to being evacuated from Yamit. It's destroyed in April of 82. When we leave Yamit, and it's rebuilt 2 months later in this area of Hevel Shalom. So just look back for a second, right? Here is the memorial right over here, right near all of these communities. So it's rebuilt to be almost exactly the same, and it's really kind of a wild thing to go and see. Other people move to different places. One of the communities that's very interesting community, also we heard about a lot on October 7th, is called Netiv HaAsara. Netiv HaAsara, as many places are, is named after a group of people who were murdered for various reasons. This is the Asara, the 10, who fell in battles in the Northern Sinai, in Pitrat Rafiach. So it's in memory of them. This is today the closest community to the Gaza Strip. It's in the north of the Gaza Strip. It's south of Ashkelon, south of Yad Mordechai. It's 400 meters from the border. It was first established in Yamit, and then when Yamit was evacuated, it was moved to here in 1982. Beautiful community. Its residents have not been allowed to come home yet. One of the very interesting projects that's done there, there's an artist there whose name is Samerit Zamir, and she's created this, you know, because they're so close to the border, they have these concrete, horrible, ugly concrete walls against the border, and she's created a project that she calls Nativ LaShalom. Nativ HaAsara means the path of the 10. Nativ LaShalom, the path to peace. And she's an artist who creates mosaics, and people come to her studio, and you can create a mosaic and be part of decorating this beautiful wall. So that's Nativ HaAsara. But now we're going to see there are communities who move to Gush Katif. So let's get to the story of Gush Katif. And in order to understand the story of Gush Katif, we have to understand the Alon plan. Okay, so over here on the right, we have a picture of Yigal Alon, who held many different roles. He was important in the army. He was important in many different places in the government. After the Six-Day War, he was deputy prime minister, and he came up with this idea called the Alon Plan, which was largely not realized, but in many ways, it was kind of the beginnings of settlement in the areas that were conquered in 1967. What's the Alon Plan? The Alon plan is to take parts of the 67 land, both in Judea and Samaria, as well as in Gaza and in Sinai. Parts of it should be settled by Israel as kind of like a security zone, a security belt, and parts of it should be given to Jordan. Okay, so if you look at the map here, again, another wonderful Gilbert map, the dark areas are where there are supposed to be Israeli settlements. And this is kind of on the belt that's closer to, that's in the desert and closer to the Jordan Valley, as well as in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. Okay? And then there are supposed to be parts like the northern part of the Gaza Strip, as well as the more mountainous green areas of Judea and Samaria that would be settled by Jordan. Okay, that would have Palestinians under the control of Jordan. There would be free passageway between these two blocks with, of course, Israel in the middle. The concept being, let's allow the Arabs to have places to settle, but not give up on our security, because the security is very important. And he believed that these zones would actually provide for Israeli security. And these zones would be annexed to Israel. And in Gaza, we're not going to go into the Alon plan in Judea and Samaria and the West Bank, although it's also very interesting. But in the area of Gaza, he had a concept of what he called five fingers. It'll be more clear in the next map that we're going to see. But basically, these five kind of, I guess, tentacles of Israeli settlement. One of them was meant to be Yamit, okay? Another two kind of in the center of Gaza. Those were going to be Gush Katif communities, okay? Another one in the north of Gaza settlements, in the Jewish settlements in the north, and another one, Netzarim. Okay, it's not exactly what we see in this map here, but this was the idea, and this was the beginning of settlements in this area called the Katif block, Gush Katif, right? Security plus agriculture, very much supported by the labor government. This is in the early 70s, encouraging people to move there, right? Places to go, expansion, settlement, agriculture, very, very diverse communities. So before we take a look at all of the different communities, this is a great chart over here, let's understand those fingers for a second. Right. So just to annotate for a second, right, we have thick one, right? So one was supposed to be down here into Yamit. That didn't happen. Okay. One was supposed to be here by Morag, okay? One by Kfar Darom, right? Also here in the northern Sinai, as well as in Netzarim. Eventually Morag, Kfar Darom, it all becomes one, right? You have all of these different communities here. Yamit, cut out of the picture, Netzarim and the Northern Sinai. And that's really the security idea behind it. We're going to come back to the security issues of a place like Netzarim, which is really very, very, very isolated. But take a look for a minute at the list of the communities here, which I think is a fascinating list. When we talk about Gush Katif, a lot of people assume, oh, okay, it's all the same. Everybody's national religious. Everybody looks the same. Everybody acts the same. No, it really was a mixture of different communities. You can see a lot of religious communities, but definitely not all of them. The communities in the north, Nisanit, Alei Sinai, Dugit, were all secular. Sorry, I'm going to just erase this. Okay. You had mixed secular and religious like Pe'at Sadeh or Rafiach Yam. You had a lot of agriculture, definitely a lot of agriculture. Agriculture was a very, very big part of Gush Katif, but not only. There were educational centers. There were fishermen. There were different kinds of people. So you really had a very diverse population. Most of these communities pretty small, right? And if you look, the biggest one here is Neve Dekalim. Okay, we'll talk about Neve Dekalim in a little bit. 2,600 people, even that, not particularly big. Okay? But really, we get a little bit of a sense of the different kinds of communities here. And they start in 1970, and they go up till 2000. This is when they're being founded. Okay, so let's move on to, and this is just to give us a sense, also the maps, just to understand the blocks. This is a great map over here on the right. The blue are the Israeli developed areas, mostly in the south of the strip. The dark brown are our favorite non-friends, UNRWA, right? The UNRWA refugee camps over here. And you can see also this block of Netzarim that's really surrounded by Arab communities and the block in the north. Okay, so it's just to understand a little bit more. And if you look at the Gilbert map, it's also helpful because it shows us the Jewish communities, the Israeli communities on the other side of the border, right? So many, what we call today Otef Aza, right? The Gaza envelope, that's what we're seeing over here, right? All the stuff we've been talking about in the last three out of four classes. So just to get a sense of that. Okay, let's talk about a few of these communities that kind of stand out. Kfar Darom is perhaps the most interesting one, right? If you remember back two classes ago, we talked about the 11 points in the Negev. Kfar Darom was one of those points. Right? It was the only one that ended up under Egyptian control in the Gaza Strip after 1948. They held on until 48. They were able to hold on, even though they were pretty isolated. In May of 1948, as the Egyptian army advances, they're besieged. They're terribly outnumbered. They managed to hold out until July of 48, and then they're evacuated secretly. They're evacuated by order of the Israeli army, and the area is destroyed by Egypt. And then in 1970, they come back. And they return, and they reestablish themselves more or less in the same place. So Kfar Darom is a very interesting example. Then we have some of these Yamit communities, and we're going to see that there are Yamit communities that are relocated twice. They have to leave Yamit, they go to Gush Katif, they rebuild again and create something beautiful in Gush Katif, and then they're relocated a second time, and now they're relocated a third time. Hopefully they'll be able to go home. And the pioneering spirit among these people is incredible. Each time to pick themselves up, to say, we're going to start, we're going to rebuild, we're going to create again. So we have a bunch of communities. Two of them I'll show you here. One is Atzmona, which was founded in Hevel Yamit, and then was relocated. We're going to come back to Atzmona in a little bit. Atzmona was always called Atzmona, even though they got a new name, Bnei Atzmon, okay, and this is the big Knesset of Bnei Atzmon in Gush Katif. Another one is a community called Elei Sinai. We saw that was all the way up in the north. It was a very secular community in Yamit that's reestablished in 1983 in the northern part of the Gaza Strip, in the northern block of Gush Katif. Okay, Gush Katif is most famous, definitely definitely among people who live in Israel and like salad and are careful about not eating bugs. Right? They are most famous for their agriculture. Amazing, amazing innovations, right? And the major innovation was what looked like a real disadvantage. And that was the fact that the land of Gush Katif didn't look like it was going to be good for agriculture because it's sand, right? And sand is not particularly good for agriculture, but that's the beauty of the Zionist enterprise. Let's take the lemons and make lemonade. And they built an agriculture in hothouses based in sand. And what they discovered, right, this was something that we did because we didn't have a lot of choices, but what they discovered was that when you grow agriculture in sand, there aren't bugs. Right. Don't ask me about the science of it. There is a science to it, but it means that you basically are able to have vegetables that usually are crawling with bugs and really need pesticides and are very, very problematic. You don't have to have that anymore. You can grow them in greenhouses, whether it's in sand or in hydroponics. And they created this really incredible, thriving agriculture. And it wasn't only the lettuce and the cauliflower and the broccoli. You also had cherry tomatoes. You also had all different kinds of agriculture. And so many of the settlers of Gush Katif were farmers, were very, very connected to the land. And one of the issues that was a real problem, so many problems with the disengagement, well, one of them was that people didn't just lose their homes, they lost their livelihoods. Right? How do you rebuild? How do you reestablish your greenhouse and your agriculture? And how do you rebuild confidence in your customers? Right? All different kinds of problems like that. A lot of the infrastructure of the greenhouses was left behind for the Arabs, who then went ahead and destroyed it. They didn't use it in a way that could have made them lots of money, and they just out of spite just came along and destroyed it. But we're not up to that story yet. So the agriculture was thriving, beautiful communities. You had educational centers in Neve de Kalim. This is the yeshiva in Neve de Kalim, which is crazy architecture, right? Take a look at it in the shape of a Magen David. The yeshiva in Neve de Kalim is actually a relocation of the yeshiva in Yamit. One of the ideas in the creation of the city of Yamit was to create a hesder yeshiva there, to create a yeshiva there for students who would study Torah and then go to the army. The first Rosh Yeshiva was Rav Yaakov Ariel, who was then later became a Rosh Yeshiva Ramat Gan, right? Very, very important figure. And the yeshiva in Yamit was relocated to Neve de Kalim. Okay? And really, this seems to be a place that could be idyllic. Right? People were drawn here for the peace and quiet. You had the beautiful beaches. There was a hotel in Neve de Kalim. All different kinds of real potential for tourism, for the economy, for all kinds of wonderful things, except then the Second Intifada began. Even before that, there were terror attacks, of course, but with the Second Intifada in 2000, things just got worse and worse, and you had multiple terrible attacks. In November 2007, you had an attack on a school bus coming from Kfar Darom. In February 2002, there was an attack on the road in the Kisufim Junction. I brought you here examples of two particularly. There were so many attacks, so many terrible ones, and so many that really kind of seared into people's minds, anyone who lived here at the time or was involved in knowing the news from Israel at the time. So the two that I brought here, on the left, I brought you a picture of the rebuilt pre-army academy, the Mechina, that was in Atzmona. Remember, we talked about Atzmona, B'nai Atzmon. Eventually, the pre-army academy was rebuilt. But in that academy, when it was in Atzmona, when it was in Gush Katif, March 7th, 2002, a terrorist snuck into the dorms at night and murdered five boys in the yeshiva itself. The mastermind of that attack, not the one who actually carried it out, but the one who planned it, a terrorist named Taysir Mubasher was actually just killed in Khan Yunis in the attacks in October when the army came and took Khan Yunis. They killed this terrorist. They found him, hunted him down, and killed him. 21 years later, one of the most powerful and terrible attacks happened as the debate about the disengagement was happening, it actually happened on the day that there was supposed to be a referendum in the Knesset on the disengagement, May 2nd, 2004. Tali Chatuel, who lived in the community of Katif, was traveling with her four daughters to Ashkelon to take part in a protest against the disengagement. Terrorists shot at her car. The car was stopped. She was killed. The terrorists came closer and murdered everyone in the car. This was one of those attacks that just hit everyone in Israel very, 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 very hard. And things just kept getting worse and worse. And this was part of the story that the public began pushing for this plan, not all of the public, but as we're going to see, there was a very strong divide among Israelis, those who said, we have to stay here, we have to hold on, and those said, who said, no, the price is too high, both for the residents and also, and maybe primarily, for the soldiers. We don't want to send our sons to this place to defend these isolated communities. What are they doing there? Okay? And that was really part of the story. And part of that that story, you can see here in the picture of the roads. Okay, the roads had to be protected because, especially for the places that are really isolated, particularly Netzarim, we'll see in a minute, but even the other communities, the roads had to be protected, and they had to be protected by soldiers. And they're surrounded by a very hostile population. How do you protect it? How do you protect these the main route over here, what the Arabs call Derech Salah Adin, right, or Route 4. It's basically a continuation of Route 4 in Israel that goes, that's the northwest route, north-south route. You also had the east-west route that comes in from Var Kisufim and goes to the major communities here, besides the road that went to Netzarim itself, which is the most isolated. And these roads become really death traps, very, very difficult, both for the people who are living here as well as for the soldiers. One of the hardest places is Netzarim, which, as we saw before, very much an enclave, much harder to protect, eventually an armed escort needed in order to travel back and forth. This is the synagogue in Netzarim. We're going to come back to it towards the end. And there's kind of a groundswell of feeling that, is this a good idea? Should we be in this place? Okay. And that groundswell is kind of picked up by Ariel Sharon, among others, who decide that there's no one to talk to in Gaza, and therefore we should act unilaterally. We should give these places to the Arabs, and in exchange, A, we won't have to protect them, B, we will save all the people that are here, and C, we will not have to deal with the demographic question. Okay, so this is all starting to be talked about 2002, 2003, 2004. We have a very interesting quote here from Ehud Olmert, November 2003. There is no doubt in my mind that very soon the government of Israel is going to have to address the demographic issue with the utmost seriousness and resolve. This issue, above all others, will dictate the solution that we must adopt. In the absence of a negotiated agreement, and I do not believe in the realistic prospect of an agreement, we need to implement a unilateral alternative, meaning we're going to leave. We don't care if you want this, you don't want this, we're going to leave. More and more Palestinians are uninterested in a negotiated two-state solution. They want to change the essence of the conflict from an Algerian paradigm to a South African one, from a struggle against occupation in their parlance to a struggle for one man, one vote, right? There's always this fear that they're going to be too many, right? They're going to overtake us. They're going to win this war of the babies, war of the demographics. And in order for us to stop that, we have to get out of there and leave it to them. For us, it would mean the end of the Jewish state. The parameters of a unilateral solution are to maximize the number of Jews, to minimize the number of Palestinians, not to withdraw the 1967 border, not to divide Jerusalem. 23 years ago, Moshe Dayan proposed unilateral autonomy. On the same wavelength, we may have to espouse unilateral separation. It would inevitably preclude a dialogue with the Palestinians for at least 25 years. Okay, so this was the thinking. The thinking was that we'll leave so that we can save ourselves. And Sharon, perhaps seeing himself like Begin, 25 years earlier, saying he's a hard right, right? He's a hardliner. Maybe he's the only one who can push this through. And of course, there's a lot of political back and forth. There's actually a referendum which is against giving back Gush Katif, but Sharon pushes through because that's what he did his entire career, and that's what he does here. Meanwhile, there's a battle. Right? There's a battle for hearts and minds. Anyone who lived in Israel at this time remembers this. It was a very, very difficult time, whatever side of the fence you were on. There are many protests. People who believe in staying in Gush Katif believed in it very, very strongly, but many Israelis were not interested. They said, yes, it's terrible. We shouldn't uproot. It's very painful for you, but we don't want our sons there anymore. Okay? And we can hark back to 20 years earlier to the battle to get out of Lebanon, right? But meanwhile, these protests are going on. Mostly they're peaceful protests. Towards the end, the Israeli army kind of seals off Gush Katif, doesn't allow people from the outside to come in. People try to come in. There are a couple of very evocative protests. One was a human chain from the Kotel all the way to the entrance to the Gaza Strip. Another protest is what you're seeing here on the right, mass protest that was meant to a mass march, really. It's called Tsa'adat HaHitchaburut, the parade of connection. Tens of thousands of people who wanted to march into Gush Katif. This is right before the disengagement is going to begin. The army doesn't allow them, and they're in Kfar Maimon, very close to the Gaza Strip, but they're not allowed in. The color, of course, is orange. Orange becomes the color of the struggle on T-shirts, on flags, everywhere. And as the day becomes closer, there's a lot of fear that there's going to be violence. And again, we'll go back to what happens 20 years earlier, okay, in Yamit. Is it going to be violent this time? How is it going to play out? Soldiers are told not to fight back. Soldiers are told to act with a lot of sensitivity. The date is, of course, a very evocative date, right? Right after Tisha B'Av, 2005, that's when they begin the disengagement. Some people leave peacefully. Others refuse to go. Most of what happens is nonviolent, but very tragic, very tragic. Soldiers crying, settlers crying, a hardcore of people who refuse to leave. The final holdout is in Netzarim, and you can see this picture, this very, very, this picture of Jewish history, basically, of the people of Netzarim taking the menorah. Remember the menorah that's on top of the synagogue, carrying it, and they ultimately bring it to the Kotel. Of course, this is evoking memories of Roman soldiers and the Arch of Titus, and that's exactly what it's supposed to do. A lot of symbolic acts on the day of the Pinoy. From one of the communities, there are people who start to pour a new roof to their house. They tear kriya. There are final prayers in the shul, which a lot of the soldiers take part in. Ultimately, despite all the pain and the protests, thank God there isn't violence. There isn't a civil war. But that's largely due to the restraint of the people in these communities who are very torn and in great pain, but they don't fight back, and there isn't violence, and there isn't a civil war. One of the great criticisms, both of the government as well as of the communities themselves, is there was no planning for the day after. Right? On the part of many of the people who lived in Gush Katif, the feeling was if we fight hard enough, if we pray hard enough, if we believe hard enough, this is not going to happen. And so there were no contingency plans. What are we going to do next? And the government was very good at destroying, was not particularly good at rebuilding, at providing money that was needed, at providing places to go. A lot of people ended up in hotels, in caravan sites, in what were called caravillas. right? That's what this is in Nitzan. One of the people who really stepped into the breach here is the rabbi of my community, Rav Yosef Svi Rimon, who right away he went to the hotels, he went to see what people needed, he went to provide counseling, but perhaps more importantly, he started an organization called Job Katif, Ta'asu Katif, which was meant to help people get back on their feet again before all their payments that they got from the government were used up by just trying to like find a place to live. And helping these farmers whose livelihood was destroyed and helping them to retrain and helping them to restart. So that was really an enormous enterprise that he took on. Today, by the way, Job Katif still exists. It's changed its name. It's now called La Ofek. And they help other people who need help. Thank God the people of Gush Katif have mostly gotten on their feet. But the organization is still going on. But there was a lot of pain. There was a lot of issues of mental health and how do we deal with our Zionism and a lot of the youth and it just very, very complicated. Finally, most of the communities were reconstituted and were reestablished. Some of them in Chevel Shalom, right, in the same area that they moved to from Yamit. So you have B'nai Nitzarim. Nitzarim reconstituted itself as the sons of Nitzarim in Chevel Shalom. There are people who went to the area of Lachish, Chevel Lachish. This picture on the right here is of the community of Shomria in the beautiful hills by Tel Lachish. Not so far from Kiryat Gat. There were communities that moved to the Golan. There were communities that moved to the Ashdod area, like Nitzan. It was a very, very difficult time. There was a lot of pain, but really, ultimately, these communities rebuilt themselves with some help from the outside and with a lot of belief in Zionism, even though the state essentially betrayed them sometimes twice. And they just wanted to rebuild and to grow and to create. And of course, the question today is, what's going to happen now, right? A lot of yearning to go back. There's a woman in my community who actually has been wearing orange for 18 years. She wears orange every day, right? With this idea that not going to stop until we return. And people say, oh, how could we ever return? First of all, they look at Gush Etzion. Here we have, we've returned. But certainly today, right? Today, suddenly, the questions are on the table again. Are we coming back? Some people may have read in the news a week or two ago, there was a big conference talking about return. It was very slammed by the U.S., but who knows? Is this a crazy idea? Is this a good idea? Here you have soldiers who are holding up a banner, Gush Katif, Chozrim Habaita, we're coming home. And there definitely is a desire among some people to come back. And the question is that a good idea? Is that a bad idea? That is not for this class to determine. I will leave you with the questions here on the table. I want to take a look at comments for a minute. In the minute that we have left. Wow, I really thought that we would be exploding with comments. You're all being very restrained. Gaza, the Egyptians did not want, and that's why we held on to it. Somebody here visited Nativ Asara, very, very nice. Tali Chatuel was also pregnant. It's a terrible, terrible, terrible story. And her husband actually ultimately remarried, has 6 kids today, but it was a horrible story. Right? Land for peace is complicated, right? Does it work? Yes, it has worked with Egypt. It's true. But I guess it depends. And we do work with Egypt, and we have a lot of cooperation with them in certain elements of security. Depends who you're dealing with. Are you dealing with, and obviously, yes, the main card, the wild card here was Hamas, which very soon after we left came into control. And Hamas is obviously not somebody that anybody can talk to. So this is a very, very complicated situation. And how will it end? I do not know. I don't know if anybody else has comments. I have to say, I'm going to use this last minute that I have to ask a question. My last class, I had thought I was going to do the communities of the Gaza envelope today, but I feel like we've done a lot of that in previous classes, and I'm open to suggestions. I retain the right of refusing all your suggestions, but I'm curious to hear if there's anything in particular about this area that people feel we haven't covered and would like to cover. You don't have to answer now. You can send me an email, too, if you think you have something interesting. What?
The demographics of the current envelope in Sderot and up to Ashkelon.
Ah, okay, maybe. Demographics. That's not a whole class, though, but it is an interesting question. Okay.
Which class that you were not going to have? Which week?
Next week we are not having. We're pushing it off to 2 weeks from today. Okay?
Okay.
Okay. Anybody who has ideas, I am happy to hear. Less politics, more history. As you all know, that's what I like. And yeah, send me your thoughts. Okay, everybody, have a wonderful rest of the week. Have a Shabbat Shalom. May we hear good news. Besorot tovot.
Amen, amen. Amen, amen. Toda rabba.
Amen.
Chodesh Tov.
Chodesh Tov. Thank you.
Toda rabba.
Thank you.